Funny is a relative concept, and we are fairly confident that our funny will not be funny for all listeners. It is not our intention to offend anybody, so all beware. There is at least one word, one sentence, one concept, or one literary visual in every parable that will offend somebody. Anybody. Somebody. Just mojo. Take my word for it, and if you are easily offended by graphic sexual imagery, foul language, racial and other stereotypes, sexual innuendos, off-color jokes, and blatant sexism, this show is not for you. Do us all a favor and go listen someplace else. You have been warned. You have been warned. You have been warned. You have been...
Good evening, everybody. Welcome back to Federal Follies. I'm your host, Nuzort. And I'd like to take a brief minute to thank my wife, Rocky, for her introduction and her warning about the contents of our show. I hope everybody heeds that. And if you're a bit thin-skinned, you go find something else to listen to. Having said that, I'd like to also apologize for not meeting our production schedule. That was entirely my fault because I had a chronic case of crotch itch, and I couldn't get away from it, you know. So as I was trying to do the show, I was grabbing this and grabbing that, and you know, you grab this and you grab that. Next thing you end up with a boner, and anyways, you know, one thing leads to another, and then the show never got produced. So anyways, I say to all, jock itch is a terrible, terrible thing. And, I think there should be some sort of foundation out there, you know, like a cancer foundation or something like that, a chronic jock itch foundation to help us guys, you know, get through this period, you know? I mean, they've got stuff that girls have to, you know, douche the pussy, you know what I mean, and make it all clean and smell nice and even taste not so bad. But, you know, there's nothing for guys. So for 3 weeks, I've been scratching this ball and scratching that ball and just haven't been able to pay attention to the show. So anyways, having released my medical records, I'm off to our new parable. So again, I hope there's something to be learned from this parable, as in all parables. And as I've said in the past, stick with me to the end because there is no straight path in my life and certainly not in my logic. So you just have to get to there with me. I'm going to kind of meander here and meander there, but it all comes together in the end, I think. So anyways, here we go. Pick your fights like you pick your nose, very carefully. Anyways, that's the way I do it, and I recommend that you do the same thing. But here we go. I was born in 1950, so in 1986 I was just 36 years old, and very happily divorced, and not paying a dime in alimony or child support. This state of post-marital bliss enabled me to devote many hours in the pursuit of my two favorite pastimes, kinky pussy and more kinky pussy. Now, the female listeners are probably thinking, I can't believe at 36, this flying, scorching, screaming asshole had as much emotional maturity as a 15-year-old adolescent boy. And to them, I can only say, in your point. Now, the male listeners, anyways, any that have listened to the first three parables, are probably thinking, I've been done, you know, been there, done that, and so what's up? Well, anyways, ladies, it's a guy thing. You gotta understand it. It's a guy thing, and it's the way God made us. It's the way He wants us. The good Lord gives almost every newborn male baby two things: a set of balls with a matching dick, in a scum-sucking, pothole-dwelling, bottom-feeding, low-life gene. You know, not the kind you wear, but the DNA type. You know, CSI things. And guys screw around all the time, and we pass that gene on in our seed from generation to generation. And it develops very, very slowly during the preteen years. And then at puberty, as the testosterone levels climb off the scale, that little low-life gene explodes in a spasm of growth. And guess what? Like a new star, a new asshole is born. Of course, the good Lord also gave us free will. That's that Catholic background I have. So some males are psychologically predisposed to controlling that low-life gene. And those guys often grow up to be your bookworm types, the geek types, you know, other boring types. While the majority, and I'm glad to say this, that while the majority of other male babies are psychologically predisposed to nurturing the low-life gene, and they grow up to be the guys that you gals go look for at the local bar for a quickie, for a one-nighter, for a good time. Of course, girls have a similar but different gene, and we'll talk about that in another parable, but for now, we need to go on. Now, most guys, freely admit that the low-life gene does get out of hand at times and often results in offensive male behavior. Have to think of it as payback. You ladies, think of it as payback for that apple thing. You know, way back when you read that about it in the book of Genesis in the Bible, and Adam and Eve, and Eve eats the apple, and she talks Adam into eating the apple. Adam, you don't eat this apple, no pussy for you tonight. So anyways, he eats the apple, and they both get thrown out of the Garden of Eden. The way we are is, it's God's way of getting back at you guys, and I kind of like to think that he has a sense of humor about it. So girls, don't take it personally. He made us that way, he likes us that way, and we like it this way. And I think you like it that way too. Because remember, you don't fuck the geeks, you fuck the bad guys. So anyways, all the naughty guys. Let me see here, a little technical adjustment on the headset here. My head's too small. Rocky says my head's too small. Now, I'm not sure if she's talking about the little head or the big head. She's probably talking about both heads, but my little head controls my big head anyways. I digress. Back to the parable. It shouldn't take any great mental exercise to figure out that if I was born in 1950, that I started government service in those waning years of that good old boy era. That was an era when, the mid-level and the senior management positions in government, they were the fenced-off territory and sort of the personal playground of fat old white guys. And they always had limited talent, no imagination, and a big sagging gut and a bad comb-over, I had a boss like that for years. He had a great wife, though. Anyways, I keep digressing. I digress. I'm getting there. Anyways, going back. The golden rule. The golden rule of the good old boy club was never, never, ever work for a black, female, or a Jew. Of course, that was never mouthed aloud. But if you listened and observed, you knew there was still plenty of life in the old boy club. I admit, I personally benefited more than once from that good old boy system. I'm not saying it was right, but it was the way things were. More technical adjustments here. As you may have already deduced from listening to the previous parables, and as I kind of mentioned when I first started, there is no direct path to the lesson. You'll just have to hang tough and meander with me through the bends and the twists in the road, but I promise to get to the lesson. And to that point, we continue our journey. And my journey starts with my first day on a new job. And I was headed to the personnel office for an employment intake interview per the error-free and clearly worded directions contained in a letter that offered me this job. The subject heading of the letter read, it's very you know, important, like notification of selection for employment. By this time, I had been in government for nearly 9 years now, and this was only one of many selection letters that would follow. But as anybody who has worked in government will readily attest, the personnel office seems to possess the universal, and I mean universal, ability to fuck up the simplest of tasks. It is a truism that anybody who works in government for any appreciable time will not escape and cannot elude the mystical machinations of the personnel office. At some point in time, the personnel office, like the sun rising in the east and setting in the west, it, like the boogeyman of your childhood, the personnel office is going to get you. Yeah, it's going to happen. You know that error-free letter with those clearly worded instructions? That freaking letter should have tipped me off right at the beginning that it was not going to be a ride in the park. I should have known better. Think about it. A fucking letter from the government without an error? There isn't a secretary alive who could make a letter without an error. Of course, now we have computers, so they do them 15 to 20 times and they're error-free now. But back in my day, they were all error-free. And of course, we kept the secretaries around because they had big tits, not because they could type anyway. So anyways, I digress. I'm back. I got to get back online here. Anyways, I did, with my letter in hand, reported for my intake interview. Oh, about 20 minutes before my scheduled appointment time. So I showed up to the office about 7:40 and confidently approached a pretty young lady in a very black, short, leather miniskirt, and she was sitting at the receptionist desk. And true to note, she definitely had big tits. And I immediately made a mental note. My next job should be in personnel. Lots of tits. Anyways, this little hottie, sitting behind this huge wooden World War II era desk, you know, they're really high, she's flashing thighs while she's answering the phone, and she's greeting all the incoming foot traffic, and she's flashing thighs, and she's, you know, shoveling paper, and she's flashing thighs. Anyways, her whole sole job was to keep the foot traffic moving in the right direction. You know, making sure every person walking through the front door reporting for an intake interview was successfully matched to a personnel specialist who was scheduled to conduct the interview. Now, isn't that bureaucratic streamlining? It makes sense. But, you know, I had trouble getting my head past the thighs. That little low-life gene causes problems for men, too. You know, I almost forgot why I was there. But anyways, the personnel specialist I was looking for had to be one of the half dozen overworked and underpaid career civil servants occupying a formation of these large gray steel desks, all sitting in straight rows directly behind the receptionist. So you had to get past the thighs. I mean, you had to get past the secretary, the receptionist, to get your interview. To tell you the truth, I could have sat in front of that desk for days, just watched the thighs. But, you know, I am being paid, so I had to use my time productively, and I carefully checked out all the female specialists, and I'll admit, I was fooled a couple of times. Some of them faked me out. I don't think they were girls. But anyways, that's the government for you. They'll hire anybody. But anyways, I also noticed that almost all of the office equipment seemed to have something broken. Just like all of my old offices that I've ever been in. I told you, this was like my 9th year in federal government, and every place I worked, there was broken office furniture. You know, everything. Desk drawers, chair backs, copiers, picture frames, lamps. You know, if they could break a floor, the floor would be broken. But anyways, there's always something broken. You know, and I had to make another mental note. And that mental note was, this is more evidence to support a theory I was developing. Now, I've always suspected that some portion, you know, some percentage of all new office furniture is deliberately ordered from a secret government agency called the Official Government Broken Furniture Catalog. And they did the acquisition people did this. And they did this just to keep people busy writing contracts to buy more furniture and more equipment. And you know what? It's called job security. I kind of figured it out. Wherever you go, there's broken furniture, so you have people that have to buy more furniture, and what a way to make sure that you don't get outsourced. You just simply buy the broken furniture at the beginning. You know, who says government employees are dummies? Anyways, I selected a comfortable and strategically positioned sofa to wait my turn for an intake interview with the personnel specialist. And of course, to ogle the women and to keep track of where that hottie's thighs were located. Would you believe it? The left arm of the sofa was broken in the personnel office, the first place somebody's going to come and see in the government when they come into work. Broken furniture. I had to make yet another mental note, adding this additional data to the mounting body of evidence supporting my broken furniture theory. I wonder where they hide that furniture catalog with all the broken furniture. And I wonder if the government has to pay extra to the manufacturer for them to manufacture the furniture broken to begin with. It's all coming together. It's almost like the Kennedy theory. But I'm telling you, it's there. It's a conspiracy. But that's another parable. We'll work on that one later. You know, me being the suave and deboner dude that I am, I camouflaged my ogling by grabbing a morning edition of this thing called a Worcester Telegram and Gazette. And my lord, what a pitiful rag of a publication that was. But it was on the coffee table, and I grabbed it, and I started going through it, and what did I note? A cracked and broken wood veneer on the coffee table. Now I'm sure the government is buying broken furniture. Anyways, I quickly, excuse me, I quickly skimmed through that Monday morning paper, but I actually read an article about global warming that was pretty interesting before I stopped at Dilly Dally in the courthouse records section, just to see if any of my buddies had been bagged for driving under the influence over the weekend, and I didn't recognize a single name, and I kind of thought that was odd. Not one of them was bagged for drunken driving, and I knew we were all shit-faced on the weekend, so I think that was probably the Worcester police were probably at the donut shop or something. But anyways, now 11:40 a.m. rolls around. Remember, I reported there at 7:40 for my interview that was going to be at 8 o'clock. 11:40, I'm still sitting on this freaking couch with the broken arm, you know? So I knew, remember, from my perfectly typed error-free letter, that my new boss was expecting me to show up at the office at 10 a.m. Well, I sure hope the boss was smart enough to figure out the personnel office had fucked up again, and that model of government efficiency and effectiveness had me sitting on my ass at 11:40 when she expected me to be there at 10. So, it took a considerable effort to mask my disappointment as a male personnel specialist approached me. I was really hoping for desk number 4. Desk number 4 had some really nice racks. But anyways, I got this guy. And so I figured it'll be a quick interview. And he was your typical, really typical government employee, personnel employee type, you know. He had the distinct markings and characteristics, you know, of that personnel specialist, job series 0301. And that kind of included the mandatory stained polyester knit pants, you know, the fashionably worn with the waist just below the Adam's apple. He also sported those huge black wide-rimmed plastic glasses that scream, you know, when I was a kid, even the girls took my lunch money. You know, and I looked at this guy and, you know, I thought this guy might even be a supervisor because he was also wearing a pocket protector and a clip on a tie, you know, so, but it turned out he was just, you know, the normal dork, normal personnel dork. I think he was probably trying to go for management. But anyways, he walked directly in front of Miss Nice Thighs, blocking the view, and approached me with his big broad smile, nothing but teeth, plastered all over his face. You know, he extends his hand in greeting, introduces himself, and then tells me, come back after lunch. 1 p.m., please don't be late. Remember, I had been sitting on that, on that couch with a broken arm since 7:40. Now he's telling me, come back at 1 p.m.? My first thought was to tell this asshole where he could stick his fucking broken couch. But, you know, after a second or two, I kind of just smiled and indicated I'd be glad to come back at 1 p.m. All the time, the little wheels upstairs are reasoning, well, I'm on the government dime. I'm getting paid for every hour I sit on a couch, and besides, there's no amount of protest or indignation is going to change the situation. This might give me just enough time to grab a couple of beers and a burger at the local ballet. You know, go to the local ballet and stuff a buck here or a buck there into a sexy lacy garter belt. You know, as a Fed employee, I need to practice being flexible to changing situations. And so I say, here's a perfect opportunity. I can be flexible. I'm a damn good bureaucrat. I'll just go to lunch. After a quick stop at the credit union, a small stack, remember, quick lunch, a small stack of $1 bills, I was off to the ballet for lunch. Now, when you actually think about it and analyze the behavior, strip joints are really very steeped in the cultural experience. Where else does dance and athleticism and music, costumes, and beverage, and food all come together? Think about it. Doesn't it strike you odd? It strikes me odd that if all of those stimuli come together in a local park on a Sunday afternoon, the community calls it a festival. But if the same stimuli come together in a dark, smoke-filled nightclub, the community calls it an attack on cultural mores and values, an affront to the family. I don't get it. But here or there, we have to move on. So I turned, put dollar bills away, had my hamburger, and I returned to the personnel office at 12:55, just as directed by that fucking dork, for my interview. And guess what? I was immediately told that I was all set and that I should just simply directly report to my new duty station. Now, I'm not even going to pretend to know what magical administrative behind the scenes whatnots occurred between the time I left for lunch and the time I returned from lunch, but somehow all was right in the world. No fucking interview required, just go to work. It must be because I'm smart. But anyways, what a waste of perfectly typed letter. Anyways, back then, before computers, they were rare. And you know, I should have kept that letter. I bet I could sell it for big bucks today, like a historical item on eBay, you know, or as a curiosity piece or something. Because let's face it, there's not a lot of perfect government work in existence, and that that is in existence is probably a rare item. Anyways, I got to report a little mishap at lunch. You know, a little food mishap. Before I went back to the office, you know, I'm having my lunch, and I'm basically a slob by nature, but hell, it was my first day on the job, and I did want to make a good impression. However, I must have squished my burger a little too hard, resulting in a little minor mustard incident. I can only offer that, you know, my mental concentration must have been interrupted by my dutiful desire to get back to the personal office on time so that I could have my interview. In that naked co-ed hanging upside down from a pole with her pussy in my face was a totally irrelevant stimuli, and it had no contribution to the mustard incident. I propose anybody could lose concentration under the emotional stress of waiting for an interview. Anyways, in any event, I did manage to squirt mustard over myself, but unfortunately, I was not made aware of that large glob of yellow mustard resting on my tie, resting on my shirt, and where else it was resting, I don't know, until my new boss, my brand new boss, asked if I enjoyed my lunch. Well, my new boss, April Thomas, a PhD in psychometrics from the University of Chicago, welcomed me into her office and immediately asked me two questions. The first one, why was I late? And the second one, did I enjoy my lunch? Before I could answer, she said, "Never mind. The answer to the first question isn't important, and the answer to the second question is obvious. It's on your tie." Next came a quick welcome to the team, and then a quick follow me. As I watched her turn, and she leaves her office, there was nothing for me to do but to try and run after her and catch up and keep up. She was a pint-sized female bullet ricocheting down the hallways, talking nonstop at warp speed. Occasionally she'd stop at this door, and then she'd stop at that door, introduce me to him or to her, or to explain this or to explain that. Anyways, it was supposed to be a one-hour orientation, but she gave it in the five-minute format, and then ended abruptly with, "Any questions?" and gone. So, we ended my little whirlwind tour in an office where the walls were all painted in battleship gray. This was a real government bureaucracy I was sitting in. You know, this is the space that I would share with three other training specialists. You know, Doc made the formal introductions to my office mates very short and very sweet. She turned on her heels, scurried down a long, dismal hallway, and that was painted in these hushed tones of puke green. It was sort of like they got a lot of people in there, and they just let it wail. It was horrible. Horrible color. But anyways, I poked my head out the door, and I was watching her ricochet down the corridor. You know, bing, bang, bing, bong. She was like a pinball. But you know, everybody she met would be given this little wave of a tiny hand, followed by a huge smile filled with oversized pearly whites. You know, I guessed this woman to be maybe 45 years old, 47 at the outside, very, very small, as I said before, just a bundle of energy. You know, nearly a year later, I learned she was 61 years old. So, I mean, like, she was in her 60s when I first met her, and I thought she was only 45. You know, and she was short, and she had a very slight physique. She actually looked kind of frail-looking, you know? She kind of struck me as, it was incongruent with the amount of energy she had. It was like, you know, some like this little atomic pill she had swallowed, and she was off and running. I bet you when she was 18, she was something. Anyway, she was like this impressive dynamo. And this was my new boss. My first day in the job, and have already broken the golden rule of the good old boy club. I found myself working for a woman. Mostly everybody addressed April Thomas as Doc. Not Mrs. Thomas, not Doc Thomas, just Doc. And as far as I know, she never asked to be called by her title, but everybody just called her Doc to show her respect. It didn't take me long to realize she was the heart, the soul, the mind, and the energy driving the directorate. You know, although she was only fourth in the pecking order behind a white male full colonel and two white male GS-15 civilian careerists, Doc was a branch chief. And branch chiefs reported to a division chief who reported to the full colonel. That was the directorate. You know, Doc was a natural-born leader in a chain of command void of any senior leadership. Now in government, this is the making of the perfect storm waiting to happen. Think about it. A female in the order of the chain of command that had leadership, and those above her who didn't have leadership. This is back in the 80s, and that was the makings for a perfect storm. Anyways, the individual in the unit training directorate was by far the largest and the most visible of two directorates that comprised the Military Intelligence Training Center and School. Now, is that an oxymoron or not? Military intelligence. Think about the last year. That should tell you why it's a military intelligence is an oxymoron. But anyways, Doc Thomas was the chief of the training analysis branch. And basically, she was tasked with the responsibility to analyze the field performance criteria for over 30 different military jobs and determine which tasks had to be trained and which didn't have to be trained. And therefore, it was very important because the soldiers would go to the field based upon what she had indicated needed to be trained. So, you know, the nature of the position constantly placed Doc Thomas at odds with most of her civilian and military colleagues. You know, and she had a quick mind and an even quicker tongue and a sharp temper. And you put that all together for a perfect storm. And then that more than occasional acidic response to a colleague's dumbass comment or question, you know, it just resulted in her being on the hot seat more often than not. Diplomacy intact was not her forte. You know, I'm in my new office digs, and they're spacious by government standards, and they had ample space to accommodate four people, and that was the good news. You know, I inherited from my predecessor this huge window. It was looking out onto this courtyard. It was like three stories below. And it was truly an outstanding perch, you know, to ogle the secretaries during lunch. You know, I'm like, this is going to be okay. The bad news, there's always bad news, was that one of the legs on my desk actually didn't belong to the desk. You know where I'm going. The original desk leg was broken during an office move, and the government movers temporarily fixed the desk by jerry-rigging a leg from a surplus desk that was headed for the junk heap. I was told this temporary fix occurred about 3 years before I even showed up. And the result of this not-so-impressive engineering solution was the desk wouldn't sit flat. It would rock to and fro whenever the lightest weight was applied off-center. You know, another mental note here. A data point to support my broken furniture theory. I'm going to buy stock in that company. Anyways, 3 weeks later, I was sitting at my window desk, and I'm ogling the secretaries at lunch, and my desk wasn't rocking to and fro anymore because I had strategically placed a copy of an Army regulations that we were supposed to pay attention to. I found a better use for it. I put it under the desk and used it to keep the desk from going to and fro. So we sort of kind of hadn't the regulation to follow, so we made things up. And I think that's the best way government works, if you ask me. You follow their regulations, it really gets fucked up. But anyways, I'm sitting at my desk and looking out the window at the secretaries. And just as I picked up the phone to make a call to the post offices club, I wanted to find out when happy hour started, I heard a strong male voice booming over the receiver. You know, the phone hadn't even rung yet, but I could clearly hear the voice asking, "Is this the end of course comprehensive testings?" I don't know. I didn't know it at the time, but this phone call would forever change my somewhat negative attitude about working for a female supervisor. The guy on the other end of the phone was Lieutenant Colonel Jeffrey Ronald Harrison. He was the owner of that voice, and I should have known by the tone of the voice that he was a muckety-muck, a division chief, or some important guy in the academic department. Should have known it, but I didn't. You know, in the organizational structure of the school that I worked in, placed all the academic departments in the training delivery directory. This place that he was looking for, this end-of-course comprehensive testing section, that's where I worked, and it was part of Doc's group assigned to this big directorate, the individual unit training directorate. It's not hard. I guess I confused you there for a minute. Two directorates, each comprised of a number of divisions and branches and sections. Intuitively, after listening to this guy on the phone for all of 20 seconds, I kind of knew. This guy's a real flamer, about to give new meaning to the term dickhead. In theory, the two directorates were on the same team working towards a singular objective. You know, trying to provide the very best training to our soldiers before they were deployed to tactical or strategic units throughout the world. That's how it should be. In reality, the two directorates got along like two pregnant alley cats in a burlap bag. The main reason for this animosity is that the academic departments were required to train only what the training analysis branch told them to train, and to add to that little seasoning to the wound, the training analysis branch was also charged with evaluating the performance of the academic departments. And they were run by men, white men. As you might expect, none of this was swallowed easily by the academic and training directorate. And thus, there was constant irritation and subsequent backfighting between the two directorates. Having a somewhat abrasive and absolutely no-nonsense female in charge of the training analysis branch did nothing to make anything better. Fortunately, the school commandant, the big mamu, the omnipotentate, the one with the big dick, he was wearing one star. He was a general, and he was well adept at wearing many hats that often included town marshal, peacemaker, mentor, and referee. You know, and it didn't hurt that the general liked Doc a lot. He actually respected her. Anyways, I want to get back to my phone conversation with Lieutenant Colonel Harrison. Anyways, he was demanding that we provide results of all of these, what they call end-of-course comprehensive tests. He wanted the results forwarded to him before they were forwarded to the commandant so he could review them. And then he wanted approval before we sent them forward to the commandant. He also informed that from now on, he wanted to review and approve all versions of the test prior to administering the test to the soldiers. Now, I had been working for Doc only maybe 3 or 4 weeks, but I knew there was a better probability of watching the sergeant major kiss the pimple off the private's ass before I would see Doc agree to Colonel Harrison's request. War drums were beating loudly, very, very loudly. You know, I was very respectful to Lieutenant Colonel Harrison. And, you know, I did the right thing. I told him he had the right section, but he had the wrong person. I redirected his call to Doc's office, and then I sat back and waited for the thermal explosion. I waited. No explosion. During the ensuing 10 days, you know, I actually forgot about the call. I just assumed that Doc squashed that dumber-than-dirt idea and everything was moving along. No problem. You know, it wasn't the case. One rainy afternoon, after a visit to the ballet, and this time I had a big stack of $1 bills, I was called at the Doc's office. She asked if I had enjoyed my lunch, or was I just wearing the same mustard-stained shirt from 3 weeks ago? I gotta learn to eat better. Anyways, before I could answer, she dove straight to the point and directed me not to comply with the colonel's request. The tone and the tenor of her voice conveyed precisely the meaning of her words. No fucking way were we going to do that. So, now we have two opposing forces on a battlefield, and there could only be one victor. I was not privy to all of the discussions and the negotiations and the endless point papers and all that other government bullshit and all the moaning and groaning and jockeying that happened behind the closed doors in the general's office. However, I knew a couple of things, even though I was there only 3 weeks. Doc was a black female GS-14. She was a civilian careerist with no military service, and she was trying to go head-to-head with a military organization headed and staffed by white-aged, you know, middle-aged bureaucrats, products of the good old boy network. You know, the guys with bad comb-overs. This is a battle she couldn't win. The short story is that Doc lost the battle, and she lost it big time. And in doing so, she managed to piss off most of the senior military and civilian management in her chain of command. The people who write her appraisals. The people who say yay and nay to promotions for her. You know, 4 years later, I was moving on to a new government position, and Doc was still the chief of the training analysis branch after 4 years. Now, during those 4 years, she had applied for many GS-15 positions as they became vacant due to retirement. But every time, she was not even provided a superficial courtesy interview. You know, Doc was black and female at a time when Uncle Sam was falling all over himself trying to diversify the workforce. If you had a pussy, if you were a minority, you got a job. You were hired. More importantly, if you had a pretty pussy and you were a minority at the same time and you were already working in government, you were going to get the promotion. Not so for Doc. Doc was not only a female and a minority, she was also eminently qualified for those positions. Her leadership really could have made a huge difference in the organization, but she had picked the wrong fight at the wrong time and bloodied her own nose. She didn't pick her nose very carefully. Obviously, she didn't pick her fight very carefully either. You know, over the years, I lost track of Doc, but some time ago, I did hear she eventually retired as a GS-15. You know, to this day, I don't know if Doc ever regretted going into battle. She knew she had no hope of winning. But I do know that her experience taught me a valuable lesson. You know, you need to pick your fights very carefully. Because as you might be right, being right may not be enough to carry you past some of the enormous and misplaced egos that plague government service. Having said that, Doc also taught me another lesson. although I'm not sure she would express it exactly as I would express it, but that lesson was sometimes you just have to say fuck it and take it on. Well, that's the story of Doc, and I hope you got the lesson from this parable. And you know, every once in a while, it's going to be a little bit more serious parable. But then this is one of those serious parables. But you know, it's a truthful parable in that in your own life. Pick your fights carefully. Pick the ones you can win. But sometimes you're going to have to just say fuck it and pick the fight that needs to be fought. So anyways, next week we're going to go back to a more less serious tone. And I think next week we're going to go for the all-awaited lesbians. That's the one entitled Never Piss Off the Office Lesbian. Again, a warning about next week's. Next week's parable, it's kind of on the rough side. So if you have any thin skin at all, stay away from us. Because next week we're going to be talking about dicks and pussy and stuff like that. And what's better. So until next week, goodbye from New Zort and Rocky. And see you next week. Hopefully we'll be on time. Bye.